This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. As we heard from David Boeri before the break, Whitey Bulger's relationship with the FBI is one of the more intriguing, controversial aspects of his career as one of Boston's top mobsters. And we'll be hearing a lot more about it when this trial begins in June.
A new book, however, out this week, takes a bigger look. It's an exhaustive personal history of Bulger and a social history of the Boston that helped to create him. Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy are two longtime Boston Globe reporters who've covered Bulger and his story for decades. They're authors of the new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you both in studio. Before we start, though, I want to throw out some questions for listeners. Listeners, the story of Whitey Bulger has been told in fact and fiction. Movies have been based on the life of Boston's most notorious mobster. But what do you want to know? What truths do you want? How do you want to separate fact from fiction in the story of Whitey Bulger? Any question you have, these are the two to answer it. So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at Radio Boston. So Kevin and Shelley, I wonder if we might start where Whitey Bulger finds himself right now in a jail cell in Plymouth. Could you describe, and Shelley, let's just start with you, describe the conditions of his confinement.
Well, he's been complaining in a letter to a friend that it's worse than Alcatraz. He says that he's locked up 23 hours a day. 5 days a week he's allowed out for 1 hour. He says he's fed through a slot in the door, which is like sort of an animal in a zoo. He said the food is often cold, and he's keeping himself fit by doing 100 push-ups a day in his cell.
A man in his 80s.
Yes.
And the cell itself is 8 feet by 12 feet. And as you mentioned, it's from this space which he's writing all these letters to friends.
Right, he has no access to TV or radio, and he's writing furiously. And the letters are long, and he seems to be limited in how much paper he has. He starts writing on the margins and in little scraps.
So how many of these letters have you seen?
I've seen from two different people. I've seen 14 from one and four from another.
Okay. So help us describe what those letters are telling us about his current state of mind. Because as you've written in a recent piece in the Globe, he talks a lot about Catherine Gregg and the fact that she's in prison right now and that he offered himself up, obviously, he offered to take the death penalty in order to keep her from going to jail.
Yeah, he describes her as the love of his life and that she actually... He mentioned in one of the letters he wished he had met her when he got out of prison for bank robbery in 1965. He believes that he would have gone straight had he met her in that time. Of course, like everything that Whitey says, I mean, he mentions that it very dramatically and very nobly offered his life up for the lady he loved if the government would show her some leniency. There was actually a much more simple, direct way to do that. He could have told Catherine Gregg, you can say anything you want about me to the authorities if that will get you leniency. But he didn't say that.
I mean, it's fascinating. You quote one of Bulger's letters to a friend saying that it's the worst punishment for him that the government is, quote, hurting her.
Whitey has always come back to him.
I mean,
what
kind of light does that shine on his mind for people who, aren't so familiar with him from,
clearly egocentric, narcissistic, whatever. I said, I'm not a psychiatrist. I just play one in my newspaper column. But I think he's a guy that everything comes back to him. So I think that, and it's interesting how his charisma, he was able to bring a certain small group of acolytes around him, and they all looked up to him and they really admired him. And I think now they sit back and look like it was always about Whitey. It was never about them.
But I think also he's very powerless right now. I mean, I think he's frustrated that here's this woman who stuck by his side. She was his loyal companion for 16 years on the run. She was the one that was taking care of him, bringing this old, former gangster to dental and doctor appointments and holding his hand, literally. He didn't like needles. And now she's serving 8 years in prison because of her loyalty to him. And by all accounts, she was a very nice person and, never committed any crimes other than, helping him evade capture.
Well, harboring a fugitive.
Right.
Sure, Whitey's very chagrined that he cannot get a Valentine to Kathy today.
Mm. Well, so let's go backward. I mean, I wanted to start there because, the story of Whitey Bulger, as you've been following it for decades, it is culminating now, in real time before us. But let's, move back to sort of the place where your book begins its exploration. Describe, the Old Harbor Housing Project, where Whitey spent his earliest years. How did his family end up there?
His family ended up there because there was a young and upcoming congressman named John McCormick, who would then go on to become the majority leader and House Speaker, who actually convinced FDR to put a housing project there. And the family was there's always, we've always associated Whitey with South Boston. In fact, he was born in Everett, outside the city. He wouldn't have, the only reason the family came to South Boston is because this project was created and they needed a place to stay. They were poor. And they moved into the project and in 1938. And that's where he grew up. And he grew up with a certain... South Boston is very fiercely loyal to itself anyway. It is literally a peninsula. And in some respects, it's an island. And in Southie... and particularly in the projects, there was an emphasis placed on loyalty to your family, loyalty to your neighborhood, loyalty to your neighbors, and that there was a price put on that. And I don't think it was probably the greatest thing you could be is to be loyal in Southie, and that's why it's interesting the way Whitey was able to use that sort of overweening sense of loyalty to his advantage. Mm.
And what? Tell us about those in the book you describe very beautifully. Simply but beautifully, the gang wars that were going on in the neighborhood and in the city, I should say, in the 60s, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I wonder if you could just describe exactly what was happening then, who were those gang wars between, and how is it that Bulger managed to use that in part, through the whole loyalty thing that you were just talking about, to rise to such power?
Timing is everything, and the greatest sense of the thing that happened to Whitey, he was locked up during most of the 60s when there was a gang war that began among the Irish, and like most things that happened with Irish criminals at that time, it involved liquor and it involved women. And the gang war that followed, there were probably anywhere from 60 on men who were killed. And there's a very strong chance that if Whitey had been on the street, he would have either been a perpetrator or a victim of that violence. In fact, he was locked up. When he came out, he was safe. He emerged. He emerged to a really depleted underworld in which he was able to rise very quickly. He had convinced everybody, including his family and prison authorities, he was going to come out of prison and go straight. But the research we did showed he dove right back into the underworld very quickly. And I think one of the reasons he did is because there was opportunity there.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Kevin, but Shelley, tell us specifically what were those opportunities? What kind of things did he do, not long after coming out of prison?
Well, initially, he started just as an enforcer for the Killeen gang. Initially, he actually had a job at the courthouse, the Suffolk County Courthouse, a job that his brother had helped get him. But I think he was the kind of guy that he wanted money in his pocket, and he was never really cut out for a 9-to-5 job. So he gravitated right back to his old friends, and he did start out as an enforcer, and it was more, gambling, loan sharking, and that changed over the years.
Yeah. Well, listeners, I'm speaking with Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy. They are co-authors of the new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. It is a fascinating history of Boston's most notorious mobster. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I've got a lot more questions for you, but there is you mentioned his brother, William Bulger, and there's someone's calling in with a question about him. So David's calling from Chestnut Hill. You're on the air, David.
Well, good afternoon. I'd be interested in knowing, why the schism between Billy and Whitey. I mean, they both became capos, but different kinds of capos. And I'd also be interested in knowing where Whitey's getting a few $100,000 to pay Jay Carney to defend him. He's never had a job in his life.
He's getting that money from you and I. He's court appointed. It's taxpayer money.
David, thank you for your call. And what about his question about, the different paths that William and Whitey took?
Again, when we try to place this in a time and place in social history, it was not unusual at all in that time and place in South Boston for, somebody to come out of the same household and do very well like Billy Bulger and become a triple eagle, go to Boston College High, college and law school, and then have somebody that went the other way. I mean, for another example of that is Kevin Weeks, who became his, you know, his protege. Kevin grew up in the project right across Old Colony Boulevard from Whitey's project, and Kevin's two brothers, Bill and Jack, went to Harvard and became very successful guys. Bill was a lawyer. Jack was a very well-respected political operative who worked with Mike Dukakis's presidential campaign. But Kevin, I think, smart enough to go to Harvard, chose not to go that way. And I think if you look at Whitey's intelligence, I mean, I think he was tested in prison at about an IQ of about 118. He clearly could have gone to college. I mean, he had the smarts to do that, but he didn't want to do that.
And
like I said, it wasn't that unusual in that milieu for one family to produce a black sheep and a white sheep.
And he really was not a student. I mean, Whitey, you know, he dropped out of high school. He got his GED when he was in the Air Force, you know, whereas Billy was, you know, going to, you know, BC High, BC College, law. Whitey, he really got his education in prison. We have a chapter we call the University of Alcatraz, and that's where he really devoted himself to reading and studying and prepping himself for when he came up.
And so, he looks back at Alcatraz the way you and I might look at our alma mater. He's very proud of that. He's maintained, he's gone out of his way throughout his life to maintain contacts with fellows that he was in Alcatraz with, the way you and I might try to keep up with our college friends.
Well, remind me the years that he was in Alcatraz?
He was there from 1959 to 62.
Okay.
But he was in prison for 9 years. But, you know, he was involved in an escape attempt, not himself, but passing a hacksaw to some other inmates trying to escape from the Atlanta penitentiary, and because of that, he was sent to Alcatraz. Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about how Whitey Bulger may not have been a student in the academic sense, but, you know, your book is full of amazing stories and vignettes about the education he received, you know, just being in Boston, living and growing up in South Boston. There's one story in particular I was wondering if you might be able to tell us. I believe it took place in 1969. And it's what happened when Bulger killed a man named Donnie McGonagall.
Just, you can take that one.
Well, it was, I mean, that was when we mentioned the earlier gang war that really encompassed all of Boston. This gang war was much more localized. It was very parochial. It was in Southie itself. It was against the Killeen gang, for whom Whitey was an enforcer, and a bunch of upstarts called the Mullins, because they hung around at a corner that was named after a soldier named Mullen. And the Mullins and the Killeen gang were at war. And the leaders, the titular leaders of the Mullen gang, the McGonagalls, and specifically Paulie McGonagall, and Whitey was driving down the street one night and while the gang war was on, and he saw this guy, and he looked at him. He said, "That's in his head, that's Paulie McGonagall." And he told Kevin Weeks, who helped us with the book, his associate, that as soon as he pointed the trigger and fired it, as soon as he fired that trigger into the face of who he thought was Paulie McGonagall, he realized it was not. It was Donnie McGonagall, his brother, who was not involved in any crime. It's that kind of, I mean, one of the things that story shows is, as much as we sort of attribute how that Whitey was a cut above most criminals, in this case, he made a mistake and a man paid for his life with it.
And he goes to, I mean, you write about how after he shoots Donnie McGonagall, he goes to a man named Billy O'Sullivan's house and, like, slumps down in the chair in the kitchen and says, "I shot the wrong guy."
That house was right around the corner from where Shelley grew up.
Yeah.
And what did O'Sullivan tell him?
"Don't worry about it. No big deal."
He said he was a smoker. He was going to die anyway.
Yeah.
How do you want your pork chops?
Pull some pork chops out of the fridge and make some a dinner or breakfast or what. So, I mean, what does this tell you about that milieu that he was in? That here's a moment where, you know, a man who's going to become a very powerful, notorious, bloodthirsty gangster has this moment of seeming regret, and the response he gets is no big deal.
I think his regret was that not necessarily that Donnie McGonagall was dead, but that he had made a mistake. I think he prided himself, and he always considered us the one thing he was most. It's funny, we mentioned Billy O'Sullivan. Everybody that I knew that knew Billy O'Sullivan said he was a terrific hunter and an assassin, but he liked the sauce too much. And he was vulnerable the night he was killed. He was assassinated himself as he was trying to enter that very same home, and he had been drinking that night, and some guys, the Mullins guys, followed him back. So Whitey really prided himself on, he didn't drink before he did a job. He didn't drink much at all, frankly. And he would have looked at that as a professional failing, not necessarily as a personal tragedy.
Shelley, did you want to add something?
No, I was going to say that Whitey, he was the guy that didn't like to lose control. He saw people that, I mean, there were many occasions where they would wait outside a bar for someone to stumble out and they would kill them. So, you know, during these gang wars. So I think that Whitey was careful not to be caught off guard. Yeah.
Listeners, I'm speaking with Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen. They're co-authors of the new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. They have incredible detail and incredible reporting about the deep history of Boston's most notorious gangster. If you have any questions for them, and there are a lot of questions still unanswered about this man's story, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take another call if we can. Mary is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to say, many years ago, probably in the early 70s, I met up with Whitey at a party at Billy Bulger's. It was after, the time at St. Patrick's Day. And at the time I was living in Framingham, and I remember there had been a mafia killing in Framingham, a Killeen guy,
Donnie Killeen.
The same guy who was in the, one of the gang members. But Whitey got a big kick out of that I was from Framingham and started talking about Killeen and with this guy he was with. And I kind of got the impression that he knew a lot about what had happened. I think it was the only mafia killing in Framingham ever. And I just got a sense of it that he had something to do with it or he knew a lot about it.
Well, that actually, Donnie Killeen was his employer. And that was a seminal act in underworld history because the killing of Donnie Killeen led to the actual truce between the Mullins gang and what was left of the Killeen's gang. And it's interesting because you would think as it ended like that, and certainly the Mullins guys did, they thought the war had ended and they had the upper hand. And yet when Howie Winter, the head of the Winter Hill Gang, was brought in to mediate this truce, he hand-selected and picked Whitey as the guy that would emerge from that rubble as the person who would be in charge of the underworld, the rackets in South Boston. And I think one of the reasons, the main reasons that happened is because of Whitey's charisma, because a guy like Howie would look at him and say, this is a guy who did time in Alcatraz. Mm-hmm. He's the real deal. They, as much as Howie liked some of the Mullins individuals like Pat Nee, and he would look at them as being a little undisciplined. They didn't come from a really formal structure. So he decided to go with a guy that was a proven moneymaker and a guy who had done time and knew what that meant. Yeah. And so in that case, Whitey's having been in prison and particularly having been in Alcatraz actually allowed him to, at that moment, become a partner in the Winter Hill Gang.
There's a couple other aspects of Bulger's criminal career which you bring a new level of detail to in your book, and I was wondering if we might talk about those for a couple minutes. I mean, amongst his many alleged murder victims, there's two that he's really obsessed with right now, and that's with Deborah Davis, who he's charged with killing via strangling in 1981, and Deborah Hussey. Okay, yeah. who died or was killed in 1985. Can you tell us the story of what happened to Deborah Hussey in particular, Shelley?
Well, Deborah Hussey, it's a very sad story. And Whitey's longtime partner and also another FBI informant, Steve Fleming, he met this woman named Marion Hussey back in the 60s. And he basically carried on. She had a little girl at the time, Deborah, who was 1.5 years old. And Steve moved in with them, and he and Marion never married, but they had three more children together. So Stevie was essentially like a stepfather to Deborah Hussey. You know, I mean, he raised her as his own daughter. But when she was a teenager, he started molesting her. And she got all messed up, you know, on drugs mm-hmm. and involved in various things. And then finally, when she was in her 20s, she confessed to her mother that he had been molesting her all these years, and the mother threw Stevie out of the house. Stevie, you know, was upset. Deborah's out there sort of uncontrollable, saying things about Stevie and Whitey. And according to Stevie Fleming, Whitey decided she's a liability, that she has to go. And Whitey is saying, no, that's not, I'm sure Whitey's going to deny that at trial. But what happened is, according to testimony by both Fleming and Kevin Weeks, Stevie pretended he was taking Deborah out shopping for a coat, a winter coat, and he brought her to this house in Southie, which we have called the Haunty, because it's been the site of several killings where people were killed and buried in the basement. And Deborah Hussey was one of those people. She was brought to the house, according to Flemmy, Whitey emerges from the, you know, one of the rooms and starts strangling her. And Weeks is upstairs and comes down and witnesses this and sees her, you know, lifeless on the floor. And then Stevie says, I'm not quite sure she's still dead, and finishes the job. So they bury her in the basement.
Well, actually, before that, I mean, apparently, Whitey took a nap afterward.
Well,
it was alleged that he took
well,
a nap.
Well, it's alleged that after all, like, yes, after several, after more than one, after a number of these murders, the, you know, according to Kevin Weeks and Steve Flemmy, Whitey seemed to get a release after, like, a stress release after killing, that he would then lie down, take a nap, and then Stevie would pull out the victim's teeth and they would stop burying the bodies. And it was very brutal and very chilling. And the murders of the women is really, you know, when Whitey was charged with, you know, the murders of the women, that really sort of changed his legend, his myth, or whatever you want to call it. It finally, people were looking, saying, wow, you know, gangsters killing gangsters is one thing,
yeah,
but 26-year-old women, you know, strangling them.
And Whitey, I mean, right now in the letters that you've been reading recently, I mean, he's really obsessed with these, because it, like, defies what he seems to have as his own sort of, he might be a criminal, but he's an honorable one who would never harm a woman.
Yeah, and you know, let's you know, it's obvious that he knows these letters that he's sending from prison
are being read.
So he's not, there are not going to be any great confessions in those letters, but he does seem very, very determined to at least let people know that, number one, as Dave Boeri talked about earlier, he insists he's not an informant, and number two, I didn't kill any women. And that's what he wrote to his friend. Now, in the case of Deborah Davis, it's really Whitey's word against Steve Flemmy's word. By all accounts, they were the only two that were present. So that's going to be a question for the jury in terms of credibility. But in the case of Deborah Hussey, you have both Kevin Weeks and Steve Flemmy saying it was Whitey Bulger who did it.
And Kevin retains a certain affection for Whitey. There was no motive for him to throw. Stevie Flemmy clearly had a motive to put the murders on Whitey. Kevin Weeks did not. And his story has been consistent from day one.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left here, and I can't let you guys go until we talk a little bit about Whitey Bulger and busing in Boston, because that was fascinating
to
me.
It was one of the best parts of the book, because we learned an awful lot. I think Shelley's unusual in this sense is that she was actually a student who was bused. She lived it. It's funny because Whitey's so aggrieved by busing, Shelley actually suffered the consequences of it.
Well, I mean, a lot of people were aggrieved by busing. I think that people now, they look, and most people probably agree it was a failed experiment in terms of how it was, you know, implemented. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, in South Boston, there was a general feeling that it was really unfair that here you are, you're taking, you know, students out of South Boston High, you're busing them across town, out of their neighborhoods to another, you know, neighborhood, but to schools that the court had found were inferior. So if
right.
the schools were inferior, why are you pulling our kids out and sending them? So I think that what I felt was the most unfair is that if you had the audacity to say that you were against busing, people said, well, you're a racist. Like, you couldn't be, there was this, like, well, you, how can you be against it? You know, not, never mind. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to go to Wellesley, never mind, you know, another part of the city.
Yeah.
I wanted to stay where I was. So,
but if I may, I mean, the difference between someone like you or people like you, like, that you know, versus Whitey Bulger,
sure.
is that Whitey Bulger does go to Wellesley,
of course,
where Judge Garrity lives. You know, and he doesn't do anything to Judge Garrity's house. He's of course the judge who signed the order to
right.
institute busing in Boston, but instead throws a Molotov cocktail through the window of a school nearby.
But
in
he was
Wellesley.
The neighborhood inventor. He felt he was justified. He was out there, you know, behind the scenes, you know, seeking revenge, really.
You're
and he did this. He did the same thing to the Kennedy birthplace
yep.
in Brookline.
He blamed the Kennedys for putting Garrity there in the first place, and then obviously he shot up the Boston Globe because he believed that the Globe had demonized all of South Boston. But the other thing is, as much as an epic tale this is and sort of a universal tale of evil and goodness and whatever in between, it's such a Boston story because then even when you look at this, the guy that played a big role in getting Whitey parole was a dean of the Boston College Law School named Bob Dryden, who then became, obviously, a congressman, first representative ever called for the impeachment of Richard Nixon. But Bob Drinan, through sheer goodness, wanted to help a guy like Whitey Bulger out and became his parole advisor and all that. Now, fast forward to the very year that Whitey walked out of on parole, in no small part because of Bob Drinan. Bob Drinan was the author of the Racial Imbalance Act here in Massachusetts. And so busing literally came to be because of Bob Drinan. And then Whitey obviously would have broken with him over that, among other things. And then Whitey's out there committing these acts of extreme violence symbolically. He, you know, Whitey was always crazy like a fox. He was not going to get caught doing stuff like that. He did it with an awful lot of calculation. But obviously, he spoke. There was an element he spoke for, and spoke for them violently.
Let's sneak in one more call quickly if we can here. Eric is calling from Sherburne. You're on the air, Eric.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I really dislike hearing about certain subjects in the press. Whitey is a person who's a murderer, a gangster that he is. I really hate sometimes the amount of publicity that they get, and really wish sometimes that they wouldn't get any, because then we wouldn't have to hear about them. And it's not that I want them, I want to not believe that things like this happen. That's not it at all. It's just, we caught him, he's in jail, we should never talk about him again.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for your call.
I have a real problem with that, because as much of this story is not as much about Whitey Bulger. Clearly it's a biography of Whitey Bulger, but the real scandal here, the real outrage, is that the FBI and the Justice Department enabled this person. Mm-hmm. They allowed and enabled him and helped him to kill people.
Kevin,
so let's not lose sight of that. This is as much about government malfeasance and misconduct as it is about a sociopath from South Boston.
The point taken, and you actually anticipated a question I was going to ask you, but the reason why I wanted to take that call is because, as you've written in your book, I mean, and said today, the story of Whitey Bulger is so much a Boston story, too. And I kind of get that sense in the call that there are some people who want to put this chapter of Boston behind
them. I totally
understand
that.
So I wonder, as we go forward to the trial, what do you think is at risk for Boston to disinter all this history?
Yeah, well, see, I think another point here is that, you may be done with it, you may be tired of it, but there are people out there, victims, family members, who have waited an awful long time for the whole story to come out. I mean, these people waited over 16 years for him to be caught. Now he's caught. And they want their trial, and they want to hear what he has to say, and they want everything to come out. And I don't, as long as you keep things secret, I just think the truth needs to come out.
Well, it is a fascinating book. Thank you so much for writing it. The book is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice, by Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy. Kevin and Shelley, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Megan.
And listeners, continue this conversation online at radioboston.org. But for now, stick with us, because when we come back, we'll hear from the Afghan Youth Orchestra. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.